WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our series on television concludes today with kids' shows. We start with a kids' show that adults love, too.
Boris, why you're coughing?
I'm used to breathing good old city smog, Natasha. This fresh air is killing me.
A lot of baby boomers learned about the Cold War from Rocky and Bullwinkle as they constantly tried to foil the plans of the two evil spies, Boris Badenov and Natasha Fatale. The cartoon series premiered in 1959. My guest Keith Scott did the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the recent Rocky and Bullwinkle film. Scott is also the historian for J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle. Scott wrote a book about the studio called The Moose That Roared. The voice of Bullwinkle was created by Bill Scott, who's no relation to Keith. Keith Scott told me how the voice was originally conceived.
Originally, Bullwinkle was always conceived as kind of, you know, I guess a generic dumb cartoon voice where in old cartoons you always heard the, which way did he go, George? Gee, Rocky. You know, so it was always these dumb sort of characters, as they used to call them. And so he made him what he described as a smart goof. In other words, there was a lot more going on in Bullwinkle's head, even though he had this kind of dumb voice.
Right. Now, what do you do to get that voice? Where do you place your voice in your head?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to physically describe where my throat is doing that, but I think it's because for, I guess, 40 years of my 46 years, I've been the world's biggest fan of this, so it's just osmosis. Listening, and also Bill Scott gave me all the original recording session tapes. So you kind of became like a fly on the wall. You could hear the actors developing these voices or get inside the actors' heads rather than just the character.
So really, I can't describe how I do this. There's a lot of air there and a lot of diaphragm and also a lot of charisma, I think.
You've also done the voice of the announcer, and you do the announcer's voice for the new Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. Who was the original announcer?
Well, that was William Conrad, who was, some of your listeners may remember the TV series Cannon. And he was kind of a fairly rotund guy, but of course, you know, all of these great voice actors that they used were originally in the days of network radio, drama, and comedy. So William Conrad was really well known as the voice of Matt Dillon in the original Gunsmoke.
And he had this very deep, rolling sort of voice. And I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
But of course, when he did the show, the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, he was a lot more cartoony, so it was,
in our last episode, those intrepid heroes, Rocky and Bullwinkle, were being followed by that vicious villain, Boris Badenoff.
That's great. I think it's really funny that you should be both doing the voice of the goofy Bullwinkle and the authoritative announcer.
It's so weird because in this new movie, there's even a line where Bullwinkle's walking through this angry crowd at the university, Wasamariu, which they recreated from the old cartoons. And the narrator says,
and our insipid hero made it through the crowd.
And then Bullwinkle says,
don't you mean intrepid hero?
And there's a little pause and he goes, no.
And did you do those voices back to back, having a conversation with yourself, or did you record them separately?
Pretty much back to back on the read-throughs and the pre-record, but as you know, on a big budget picture like this, eventually everything gets replaced. And I think for consistency of character, it's better if you read just one character's lines. In fact, even in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, Mel Blanc always used to admit that he'd do all of Bugs Bunny's lines first and then come back and do Yosemite Sam, or he wouldn't have a voice box left.
Right. Now, you don't do the voice of the Russian spy, Boris Badenov, in the movie, but you have done Boris Badenov for other versions of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Well, you know, I actually I do Boris's voice in the movie. There's a short section where you see the characters in normal cell animation.
Mm-hmm. You want to give us a little taste of Boris?
This Boris bad enough. Incompetent little Botsylvanian spy. Oh boy, Natasha.
What a great laugh. No, who is that voice based on?
Well, Paul Frees, the originator of the voice of Boris Badenoff and many, many other voices on the old cartoons, actually admitted that he took Boris's voice from a veteran character actor named Akim Tamarov, who, you know, I guess you could see him in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lot of old films from the 40s, like For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he was always these little, very charismatic villains, often with that Balkan dialect. So he took a bit of that, and then a little bit of this character that a Jewish comic called Bert Gordon did on the Eddie Cantor show. It was one of those weekly characters that used to appear on old-time radio. The audience would look forward to it. It was called the Mad Russian. And it was always, how do you do? So I think he just kind of combined those two voices, and we had this crazy villain.
For anyone who's never seen Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, what's the basic premise?
Well, the premise is that these two zany-looking heroes, you know, the design is just so cheap and funny. This very tall moose and this very short squirrel are best buddies. They live in Frostbite Falls, Minnesota. And in every adventure, they travel the world and foil the plans of this Cold War villain couple, Boris Badenoff and Natasha Fatal. And they do it just by lucking out, mainly. So the whole thing is a takeoff on melodrama and, white-hatted heroes. But it's just done in a very light-hearted, charming, satirical style. But the main thing to say about these cartoons is that they all eventuated when there was so much competition of bland cartoons, you know, cats chasing mice and that sort of thing. So that these stood out for anyone who Bill Scott used to call the smart kids, suddenly picked these out as something special because at the same time that, you know, Yogi Bear was stealing a pie off the windowsill, Rocky and Bullwinkle were satirizing politics and TV executives and things that really were way over the kids' heads, so that Bill Scott and Jay Ward used to say you could keep coming back to these cartoons from young childhood through early high school and then into adulthood on three different levels. Then you'd keep getting things that you didn't get the previous time.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons? And in this one, the spies Boris and Natasha have drained Lake Salle de Bain, which, of course, in French means bathroom.
and
they've drained the lake. They've basically pulled a plug to drain the lake in order to get at a trunk of treasure buried at the bottom. And after they get the
treasure of the treasure chest of Montezuma.
Yes, I kept expecting Montezuma's revenge to be the end of this. But after they get the chest with the treasure in it, they can't open the chest. So they throw it off a little mountain, hoping that when it hits the ground, it will open. But what happens is Boris Badenov ends up falling off the little mountain with the chest, and the chest lands on top of him. As he's falling, Natasha yells some advice to him.
Don't worry, darling. Remember, this is just cartoon. Boris, are you all right?
Natasha, I just found out what happens when a cartoon chest falls on a cartoon character.
What?
It hurts!
And what's more, darling?
What could be what's more?
The chest still isn't open.
Fui and double fui.
That voice, Bullwinkle! Where have I heard that voice?
I heard something like it once when I dropped the chicken bone in the garbage disposal.
That does it, Natasha. Come on. We're going to get an A-bomb.
A-bomb?
A-bomb, come on.
Did you hear that, Bullwinkle?
Sure, they repeated it twice.
Do you know what A-bomb means?
Certainly. A-bomb is what some people call our program.
I don't think that's so funny.
Neither do they, apparently.
Do you know why Jay Ward decided to have these two Russian spies and make it a Cold War comedy?
I believe that was Bill Scott's decision. He wrote the script for the pilot film, and I think he wrote it in around about Christmas of 1957, and that, of course, was Sputnik era, and it was when the tensions of the Cold War were you know, at their height. So it was, I think it was just topical, and he was a very topical person. He was, if he hadn't been in animation, I'm sure he would have been one of these comedians like Stan Freberg, you know, who was doing whatever was in the news at the time. Not mother-in-law jokes, but I'm talking like political jokes, you know. So I think then when they created the characters, they based the look of it kind of as a tribute to Charles Adams, the cartoonist, you know, with the Adams family. Gomez and Morticia, as they were named in the TV show, they never had a name in the old panel cartoons, looked very much like Boris and Natasha. I think once that story developed and then the show was picked up and renewed, they decided to keep those villains because the Cold War had continued, and they were just, they had ended up in the first 40 episodes as very funny, bumbling characters that looked viable for a long life.
Do you know anything about Jay Ward's and Bill Scott's politics?
The only thing I knew is that, as you know, as I mentioned, Bill Scott's son said that my dad was a screaming lefty, and he was. I mean, he was involved in many causes. He did commercials for Mental Health Foundation. He was a member of the Civil Liberties Union, and Jay Ward, strangely enough, was a staunch Republican. And yet these two got on and giggled all day long, and they were totally politically opposed.
Many of the jokes in Rocky and Bullwinkle had to go over the heads of kids who were watching. Did Jay Ward care whether kids got the jokes or not?
I don't think he really cared, because he was clever enough to realize that they could see it, especially very small kids could watch the cartoons and be enchanted by the odd-looking design. And just the storyline itself, there was a sense of adventure that even the youngest audiences got. But he always spoke very intelligently about his audiences. Whenever he got dictation from the networks or the sponsor saying, you know, too many adult references, too much showbiz material, you know, you're going to offend some Greek national if you do that dialect, you know, or complaint after complaint. And he would always say, you know, the kids are going to get this. You know, audiences have brains. So both of them presumed a degree of intelligence in the viewers, which network people were renowned for doing the complete opposite, you know.
My guest is Keith Scott, the official historian of Jay Ward Productions, which created Rocky and Bullwinkle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Keith Scott. His book, The Moose That Roared, tells the history of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He did the voices of Bullwinkle and the announcer in the recent Rocky and Bullwinkle film. I grew up on cartoons. You grew up on cartoons. I know some of my dreams were affected by cartoons. I used to have this recurring dream where I'd be like driving in a convertible and I'd kind of crash into something and I'd go kind of like flying up into the sky and then slowly fly down, as only happens in cartoons. But I'm wondering if any of your sense of if any of your dreams or things like that were influenced at all by cartoon physics.
That could well be, because I'm always thinking in terms of gags. You know, when they were doing the old Laurel and Hardy shorts here in Hollywood or Culver City, Stan Laurel had that kind of a mind. If he was driving along and had to brake quickly, his mind would immediately snap to what would happen in a gag, even though he almost just got killed, you know. I tend to be like that. It's this constant exposure to the comedy and the dynamics of cartoons and the rhythm of comedy. So I don't know if that's a good thing or bad.
Do you have any strong feelings about parents and TV executives who actually worry about cartoon violence?
Yeah, I think that's a little exaggerated, because they always seem to quote the Roadrunner. And the violence only happens to the coyote in that, and it's self-inflicted. His traps don't work, or he keeps falling off a cliff and ending up looking like an accordion when he walks, and then suddenly he's back to normal again. I'm convinced that all the kids I knew when I was very young knew that it was just a cartoon, in inverted commas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a gag.
You know, I'm thinking in one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, Rocky and Bullwinkle make a joke about how the network executives don't like violent cartoons. And this was back in the 50s or early 60s, this cartoon.
Yeah, I think that what happened was that they had drawn them in one episode as if they were going to fall into a cannibal pot on this island of Rikki Tikki. And they got some dictation from the network saying, well, we won't allow cannibalism with our characters. And Jay Ward actually sent a serious letter saying, cannibalism? To eat a moose and squirrel? And that was publicized in Newsweek. And then about the second storyline after that, there was a scene where Rocky and Bullwinkle are captured by a gigantic Native American and tied to a stake and just about to be set fire to. And Rocky whips out a contract and says, the network says, no cannibalism on TV. So he was always biting the hand that fed him. He was kind of a maverick. I'm sure he was one of those people in those days. They used to mutter and shake their heads and say, I don't know, you know, can we end this contract as soon as possible? This guy's too much trouble.
You started off doing voices for cartoons and commercials in Australia. Mm-hmm. What kinds of characters on the cartoons and commercials?
Very similar to what the Jay Ward actors did, because when you're doing cartoons, sometimes they'll show you a model sheet of a character, and they say, well, it's kind of like, you know, and then generally when they say that, it means it's either an impersonation of a famous, you know, actor or an exaggeration of that person. So there's a local cartoon series that we make in Sydney for based on a German property. Of course, it's redubbed when it goes back to Europe. But I do the two villainous characters in that, and I based
one of them on this very sort of temperamental character that there's a radio actor here in Hollywood called Joseph Kearns used to play Mr. Wilson on Dennis the Menace, you see.
And then his offsider was called James. And they were just kidding around when we saw this little penguin, this very obsequious little penguin. And for some reason they called him James. So everyone just looked at each other and said, James Mason.
So I've got this little penguin who talks like James Mason. Yes, master, whatever you say.
It's funny because one of the things you have to do while you're doing all these voices is drop your Australian accent. Like, you can't do Bullwinkle with an Australian accent. Or maybe you could. That would be interesting.
Well, I don't know about that, mate.
Right. So you had to learn to speak American, among other things.
Yes, I think it's because of my interest in animation history and so on. I've kind of had the American dialects in my head for so many decades that it's very easy for me to hear with a pair of headphones on if I'm doing the accent correctly, you know. And also with British voices. I mean, I can put on a very broad Australian, you know, like Paul Hogan, you know, one of those Australians.
Right.
And then I think it's just through constant listening to tapes of famous people that I could go from, you know, doing Paul Hogan to a very well-known English voice like Alec Guinness. I want you to build that bridge and officers will do the work of enlisted men. And then go to some American voice.
Like Bullwinkle Moose.
Or even an amalgam, you know, like an American star, but with one of those odd accents like Schwarzenegger, who's like,
I am a cybernetic organism, living tissue over metallic parts.
or Stallone, which is kind of almost a cartoon voice in himself.
I need no manager, you know.
That's true. It is really almost a cartoon voice in itself.
It is. It's very, you know, because that scene in Rocky with Burgess Meredith where he said, come on, kid, listen, I got pain, I got experience.
Oh, I got pain, I got experience too, you know.
Keith Scott, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry, and I've just got a couple of friends here who just want to say goodbye.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. Bullwinkle G. Moose here, and doing your show has been kind of a breath of fresh air. You get it? I said,
oh, go away, Moose. That was stupid.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
That's great. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you a lot, Terry.
Keith Scott recorded earlier this summer. His book is called The Moose That Roared. More on Kids TV in the second half of the show. In the meantime, here's a song from Schoolhouse Rock, sung by Dave Frischberg and the show's music director, Bob Durow, from their forthcoming CD, Who's On First? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.